Hello and welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey Karras and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And I've just spilt my coffee everywhere, so I may not be very coherent today without that. But this week we've been reading The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. But first, book news. And I haven't seen you, Annie, but in the meantime, the Miles Franklin shortlist has been announced.
It feels like a while ago now.
It does. I don't know why after we waited so long.
I know.
So we did talk about the long list and I wasn't too surprised by the shortlist. No. Let's run through quickly. The Yield by Tara June Winch, Exploded View by Carrie Tiffany, The White Girl by Tony Birch, No One by John Hughes,
which is a bit of a dark horse, and then Philip Salem with The Returns.
Peggy Frew
with Islands, yeah.
Yes. So, which I haven't read.
No, either. But I've heard such good things about it.
I'm very happy to see Exploded View getting that recognition, and I think it would be a worthy winner just because it's such a masterful gem of a book, and I recommend everyone read that. The Yield by Tara June Winch is possibly the favourite, would you say?
I'd say so, yeah.
And you loved that.
I did. That's definitely my favourite.
That was Annie's book of the year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Last year. And you're not alone. A lot of people I know have really loved that book. So I recommend checking that out. The White Girl by Tony Birch, I've just bought.
Oh, cool.
And I'm really looking forward to that. Jacqueline at 6 Minutes for Me has been raving about it. She started reading it. I'll try to read that before the winner's announced. And then I think I would have read three at least from the shortlist.
The one that I'm a bit of a dark horse about is the Philip Salem book, because I don't know much about it. It sounds like it's got quite a good premise. It's a woman puts a room up for rent in her apartment and an old man comes in and joins as the lodger. But anyway, it's one of the only books that I sold to someone, and then she brought it back and said, look, I've read 50 pages and I just cannot go on. I hate it. Can I swap it for something else?
That's brilliant.
I said she could. Yeah. And so then it's been sitting on the shelf with me having that in my mind. And then it gets nominated for the Miles Franklin. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, either she just totally missed it or
interesting.
So
I love a divisive book.
Totally.
That's great.
Yeah. So that's my only bit of knowledge about that one. Mm. And then Peggy Frew, I really like her writing, but her books are often really heavy. So I've put off reading Islands, but I have heard incredible things about that too. So,
okay. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Sorry. And I should have said that's an award given to an excellent work of literature showing an aspect of Australian life.
Yeah.
So it's a very prestigious award.
And it's actually the first time that two Indigenous writers have been nominated on the shortlist since the 60s.
Wow. Mm. Wow. Okay.
Which is telling.
Yes. Yeah, but good.
Absolutely.
That's a positive. I don't know the date of the announcement.
No, me neither.
No. So, but we will keep you posted. And the other thing that's been bubbling away this week, and it's a follow-up to, it's a bit of a follow-up to the news that Amanda and I spoke about recently with J.K. Rowling and her transphobic comments or comments about gender identity, is that Baroness Nicholson, whose late husband, Michael Caine, was a founder of the Booker Prize, and Baroness Nicholson herself has sat on the board until 2009 and since then has been an honorary vice president of the Booker Prize, has come out and made some transphobic comments as well, and has, in particular, she called, there's a transgender model called Munro Bergdorf, who Baroness Nicholson called a weird creature, and I think it went beyond that and made some, well, Munro Bergdorf called them bullying comments towards her. And then she's tweeted about how she voted against the same-sex marriage bill in 2013 because she thinks that will erode the rights of women and girls. And so in response to that, people have called on the Booker Prize to respond, because she holds this elite position and powerful position as a vice president of that organisation, and it is such an important prize. And they initially responded with a fairly wishy-washy statement saying, oh, the comments of Baroness Nicholson are not her own comments and don't reflect the views of the Booker Prize. And there was sort of another outcry. People like Damien Barr, who we saw in Adelaide recently, and others, Marlon James, who's a former Booker winner, just saying, well, that's just a
not good enough,
not good enough response. Yeah. That wasn't his word, but that's, you know, you get the idea. And so they actually did come out yesterday with a fuller response saying the issues are complex, but our principles are clear. We deplore racism, homophobia and transphobia and do not discriminate on any grounds. And yeah, literature, this is what you were saying, literature is open, plural and questioning, and every author's work should be approached by readers in the same spirit. And integrity is central to both Booker Prizes because they also run the International Booker Prize. And so what they've done is they've reflected on these honorary roles that they hand out, so the honorary vice president role, and decided they don't need them and they've abolished those roles. So her role as vice president has been abolished, and so have the other vice presidents, which I thought could be a bit unfair to them. But if as is the case, that they don't actually do anything, I suppose it doesn't. It's really for the prestige and maybe that doesn't matter for them. But that was received with some level of thanks, and I think a lot of people saying thank you for listening, because at least as an organisation they ended up getting it right. Even
and I think
though
so often in these situations, you know, the words happen but the action doesn't. And so I think this is kind of a reflection, and as you say, it is a bit painting everyone with the same brush and not necessarily singling her out. But I think at least some action has happened rather than just saying, oh, we're sorry and we don't want to be close to that person. But still giving her the, as you say, the prestige.
And the way I view it, I know that these things are personal, especially if you're the victim of bullying or harassment in that sort of regard. But the way I view it, it actually isn't personal about her. It's I look at it as a governance issue for the
absolutely.
The Booker Prize,
it's
and
a risk.
Them looking after their organisation, and it's a risk having, you know, to be associated with someone who they're giving a very senior role, albeit maybe just a ceremonial role, who doesn't act in accordance with their values. And it's not a case where she has personal views that they might disagree with, which of course everybody has various views on all sorts of subjects, but these are views that she's been publicly touting, and that's where it runs against their values. But having said that, I looked at the Booker Prize website to see what are their values, because I thought that was an interesting question, and there's nothing on the website. It might be that they have them written down somewhere in an office somewhere, I don't know, but there's a very clear statement about what they're there for, which is the foundation is there to award the Booker Prize, and that is for the best novel as decided by a panel of judges, and they have a range of judges from different backgrounds or different areas of publishing, and they think that's what gives the prize its common people feel, and so that's quite clear. But there's nothing else about the values that, for example, they mention in the statement. So it's just interesting from a governance perspective.
Totally.
As an organisation, you know, are they actually clear about what they stand for and that sort of thing?
Because
and that's where
have some kind of,
well, I think when you don't have that clarity, that's where you do run into trouble, because when something like this happens, you don't, you know, you don't have a clear statement.
And especially if you're trying to apply that retrospectively, you know, that if they now develop one, they'll have to go back and apply that to all the members of the board currently, which is tricky politically and practically, you know.
And it made me think, actually, because we've been reading, well, we'll be talking about The Paying Guests by Sarah Waters in a few weeks, and she's a lesbian author, and her books have featured same-sex relationships. She's been nominated, or she's been shortlisted for the Booker Prize 3 times and never won. And I haven't read those 3 books, so I can't comment on whether they should have won. But if you have a judge or someone in a senior role on the foundation, a director who is actively homophobic, doesn't that just make your brain start ticking as to how that can clash perhaps with the prize's values, or what those prizes, what the Booker Prize values have been. Maybe not what they are now, but what they were in those years. So it's quite interesting. And I think it's just interesting because it is such a prestigious prize. Mm-hmm. It lost a bit of its luster for me last year when they did the Tide prize. Let's not talk about that. Matthew Sharapa tweeted this week, seven things I'm still grumpy about. And one of them was the Tide Booker Prize in the like bookish things.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm still cross about that too, now that you mention it. So it did lose its luster, but it is such an important prize. Mm. And I think that's why, you know, these issues, when they come up, people do really care about this stuff. Now on to our book of the week, The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. Colson Whitehead almost needs no introduction, I think, but just to run through some of his many achievements and accolades. He's an African-American novelist. He's written seven novels and he also writes nonfiction as well. He was born in New York City. His parents were successful entrepreneurs and he went to the Trinity School and then went to Harvard where he graduated in 91 and he lives in Manhattan. Of his seven novels, probably the best known is The Underground Railroad, which was published in 2016, and that reimagines the era of slavery through the main character Cora, who escapes through this Underground Railroad that he reimagines as a physical railroad, not just the network of people, and travels north. And so you see all the states and how slavery was implemented and how that era oppressed black people.
I think for me it was
very
like
vividly
the legacy of America being imagined as a free country is such a lie. All of these institutions were built on black bodies and with the use of black slavery.
Yes. It was very, very vividly done, and through seeing it through one character being Cora, it really brings it home and makes it very accessible, I think. And that book, The Underground Railroad, won the National Book Award. It won the Pulitzer Prize and various other awards. Barack Obama selected it as his,
one of the books,
you know,
of the
Oprah
year.
Winfrey had it in her book club and so on. And that's when I first heard of Colson Whitehead, so I hadn't heard of his earlier work, but he had in 2002 won a MacArthur Fellowship, which is also known as the Genius Grant. Yeah. That is a really significant award, monetary-wise and also prestige-wise, but one that no one has heard of.
Yeah.
There was a really funny episode of the Book Riot podcast recently where Jeff and Rebecca were just nerding out about all the book awards and which one would you rather win, you know, the one that everyone knows about but doesn't give you much money or the, you know.
Well, it seems so practical, that one. You know, it really gives you a leg up to another level of your career.
Yeah, and it's awarded to someone for their potential, someone who's shown sort of genius or outstanding creative ability and also a capacity for hard work and self-direction, and then they give them that award to invest in their future. So
incredible.
It's a really wonderful, no strings attached award. I think Zadie Smith might be a previous recipient, and George Saunders.
Yeah.
And it's actually a good one to watch as to who's going forward.
Future,
so Valeria Luiselli is a recent winner. But anyhow, so he's a genius already. And then The Nickel Boys, which is the book we're talking about today, published in 2019, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for fiction. And he's only the fourth author to receive it twice. That's
incredible.
Actually quite hard to say.
Yeah. Fourth author.
And he has said he grew up wanting to be a black version of Stephen King, the horror writer. And his
range. Gone slightly away from that remit, but in good direction.
Yes, he has, but his range is incredible. So he's written zombies, he's written
speculative fiction, I would call it.
Speculative fiction. Yeah. And
Underground Railroad won the Hugo as well, I'm pretty sure.
Yes,
which
because
is a sci-fi prize.
It has a supernatural element of the actual railroad, which didn't really exist.
No.
So it has that element to it, even though most of the story is very grounded in, you know,
reality,
the fields and the real things that she was witnessing. And then The Nickel Boys is historical fiction. Mm. And so he has all this capacity he's so versatile. Mm. And this is one of the discussions that they had on the Book Riot podcast when he won the Pulitzer for the second time, is he's done all of this and he's only just 50. Mm. So relatively young in terms of a career as a multi-award-winning author, mm-hmm. and he's still got so long to go, and you just don't know what he'll do next because he's got
it's exciting,
this range of genres that he writes across.
I read he's just finished a crime novel.
Yeah, I can't wait. Cannot wait. So The Nickel Boys is the story of two boys, Elwood and Tucker. It's set in the 1970s and they're both sent to this reform school, and it's based on the real life school of the Florida School for Boys, which was also known as the Dozier School for Boys, which was a state-run institution where children were sent for sometimes minor offences but suffered horrific abuse at the school, including death. So this all came up in the – Ben Montgomery wrote some articles in the Tampa Bay Times, and Colson Whitehead refers to this at the end of the book. So he gives you a lot of resources if you want to read more into the real-life story. And it is a case of truth is stranger than fiction, or, you know, sometimes you can't make up what humans have been capable of and how horrific something might be, that you've just read a fiction novel thinking, well, this is just, wow, you know, terrible. And then you realise that it actually did happen that way. It's quite shocking. Elwood, so the two boys, Elwood has had a strict upbringing with his grandmother. He's very hardworking. He's about to do some college subjects, even though he's still at school. And so the world is really his oyster at this point. He, you know, he's quite naive and nerdy, wears glasses, and he's the diligent student. Tucker hasn't had the same advantages, but he's very street smart and he works the system. So in one of the early scenes at the reform school, he puts himself into hospital because he wants a rest. And so he's eaten some soap flakes to make himself sick. So he kind of knows how to, and that might shock you, even just thinking about that is quite shocking, but it's an example of him knowing how to work the system and thinking it's really tough, this labour that they made the boys do at the school. So I need a rest. Even though I'm going to make myself feel incredibly sick, I'd much rather just go to hospital for a day, which is, you know.
And I think he says in that scene that it's about control as well, that he puts himself in the hospital, no one else does.
That's right. That was a really, really important line, I think, that he says, but I chose to do this.
Yeah,
it was his way of having some autonomy. It's a heartbreaking book in many ways. So there are some articles that have been written about the school that I think Colson Whitehead saw that prompted him to write about it. And the school didn't close until 2011. So this has all been quite recent. And I think there were other schools like it, but this is just the one example. So then they've also had archaeology students working to dig up the graves. There are some graves on the site. And the book opens with the line, "Even in death, the boys were trouble." So it's a cracking first line. And it starts with the archaeology students digging up and finding these graves. And just to give you a sense of the satirical humour in the book, he talks about how that was really inconvenient for the company that wanted to buy the site because, of course, it's closed down in the state. And this did happen. The state of Florida wants to sell the land but then runs into this this sort of hurdle that they're discovering grave sites. It was 100. It could be up to 200 now, and they're still discovering them. And initially the state refused to exhume them and they just wanted to sell the land. And then some of the families, I think, went to court and they got an injunction. And so they've now sent their students or the archaeologists to go. And so it is happening now and they're trying to identify and so on. It's horrific, but even in that in those first few pages, it is funny in a way, because that you can just imagine someone in an office who's trying to do a land deal, basically, and someone comes in and says, "Oh, look, they've found some, you know, graves, and it's going to take a bit longer." And this, you know, and someone who's just wanting to make some money out of a property development, just, "Oh, really?" You
Not
know,
again.
And the sort of the inconvenience of it is. It's unfortunately, you know, it's so realistic and it's done with such an acute sense of satire. Yeah, so that's the setup. So you have the two boys at the school, and there's also a coming into the present day. It's set in the 1970s, but there's also a section in the present day where one of the characters is looking back on his time there. Yes, as I said, it won the Pulitzer. It has been described as a necessary read by Barack Obama, a commanding triumph by the Sunday Times. Time has called Colson Whitehead one of the greatest American writers alive, and I think he was on the cover of Time America's storyteller. Yep. What did you think, Annie?
Yeah, it's incredible. I'm not going to argue with any of those laudable places. It's a really eye-opening read. I think it's an incredible work of restraint because, and I think I thought the same thing about Underground Railroad. So much of the violence happens off the page. He doesn't try and shock you. Or it's not kind of a horror film or a horror book. It's the understated and everyday nature of the violence that these boys experience that is so horrific. And I think it's really interesting that he's chosen these two characters. So Elwood, as you say, is the kind of good boy. He does everything right. He, both of his parents ran away when he was young and his grandmother has raised him. And she has been so afraid of this happening to him because she knows that it's a real possibility. She's lost so many of the men, especially in her life, to violence and to injustice that she really brings him up incredibly correctly and he still manages to be a victim of this system because, as you say, as he's trying to catch a lift to college, he gets in the wrong car with the wrong person. He's trying to make the best decision in a bad world.
Yeah.
And so the first black driver that he pulls over, he gets a lift with, and it turns out that that man has stolen the car.
Mm.
And so you don't get a trial, you don't see any of that. He just is straight to reform school.
Yeah.
To contrast.
And I should have said it's two black boys, so Elwood and Tucker are black boys and the school segregates the white children and the black, or they're all boys, aren't they? Yep, the white boys and the black boys, and they all of the children suffer abuse, and it's worse in the black boys section.
Yeah.
So,
But yeah, and then you have Tucker, who has, as you say, has grown up in on the wrong side of the tracks. You know, has had family violence and various issues, not giving him the best start, and he's in exactly the same place. And I think the book does a good job of, I think sometimes in the kind of Black Lives Matter movement, the kind of lives that we hold up as mattering are the ones where someone has lived an impeccable life. But I think what Colson Whitehead is saying is that no matter what kind of life you have lived, your life should have value. And I think that's a really incredible and powerful message. But yeah, I think it's an incredibly restrained book. I think it takes you to the very edge of what is bearable but doesn't overstep that mark. I too was a bit daunted about reading it, and I think once I got into it, I was just hooked. I read it in 2 days, you know.
Yes.
It's a quick read in many ways because he's such a skilled writer, and I think that some of the horror is manageable in a way because he has this really, as you say, semi-satirical, kind of detached, almost, I kept wanting to say fairy tale, but I don't know whether that's just because in my situation as a white woman in Australia, this is unimaginable to me.
Yeah. But or maybe because it's children.
I think towards the end, and it doesn't wrap up neatly, but I think there's this kind of sense of it happening in a magical landscape or some kind of, I don't know where I'm getting that from.
Well, it's interesting because the school itself is beautifully manicured and they put on a show with the Christmas lights and the boys are gardening every day. There's no real school going on, even though they say to all the parents that the boys are getting an education. There's none of that. And so the actual presentation of the school, it looks beautiful. So that's really horrific. It's kind of creepy as well, isn't it? It's really sinister. But no, I put off reading it and I thought it would be more harrowing than it was, but I just absolutely loved it. And it is all about the writing and it's all about the characters, and it is, as you say, gripping. So I read it in two sittings as well, I think, but it's one of those rare books that is so quick to read because it whips along and it's really compelling and suspenseful, but it's a rare book that I actually want to slow down a bit to appreciate the sentences because he's such a masterful writer, which doesn't often happen because I'm such an impatient reader normally.
And I think he doesn't spell everything out for you. Like, I think there are moments where you have to slow down and kind of reread a sentence or reread a paragraph because a lot of, as I say, the injustice doesn't get put on the page. And you just think, how could this be state sanctioned for so long and so many people had to turn a blind eye or be actively complicit in it?
I think that's right. There's active complicity, and there's also when they would do the inspections, you know, from time to time, and this did happen, you know, the state would come and do an inspection because someone's complained about something or somehow words got out. And, of course, someone gets a warning about that, and so it's all tidied up and looks impeccable for the inspection. But, you know, and the boys are eating all the good food on that one day, and that almost makes it worse, doesn't it? No, I just thought it was so brilliant. I think I liked it even more than the Underground Underground Railroad. It was really tight. It's just so strong, and you care about the characters, and this is what makes or breaks a book at the end of the day, because otherwise you might as well write a non-fiction piece, you know. But this one, you care about Elwood, you care about Tucker, and the way that he threads the humour through, so that even though you're finding it funny and at the same time you're feeling the dread and the suspense of what will happen to these boys and, you know, what is happening to the boys, he gives you that balance. He lets you have that humour, which I think reflects human nature, because we have that, you know.
Especially in times of darkness, you need something to laugh at.
You need something. Yeah. And also you can see sometimes it's absurd. You know, there's an absurdity in those dark things that human beings do, that I think we often do have a sense of that. Yeah, so I really liked that. The writing is incredible. Every sentence has action, matters. It tells you something about the character or something about the story. Mm. Not a word is wasted. And yeah, I just thought it was brilliantly done.
Yeah, and it's incredible to reflect. I mean, as you say, the school in Florida only closed in 2011. Think about what happens here in Australia. I just kept thinking about the Don Dale Detention Centre in Northern Territory, where, I mean, they're not even disguising it behind the guise of a school. These things are definitely happening to, I think it's like 98% of the incarcerated children in the Northern Territory Aboriginal. It's happening. It's still happening. And this is the kind of book that I think can both open your eyes and make you incredibly angry and think about just no one deserves any of this treatment, and this is what happens when power goes unchecked.
I agree. I think having the violence happen off the page, I just appreciated it, because it gives – he shows the respect to the reader to know that we will – read between the lines of that.
It's powerful.
And there are a couple of moments in the book that really do break your heart, but on the whole, it's not a heavy, depressing read.
No.
And I know that sounds strange to say given the subject matter, but I think that is so important.
He's
because
got a
it's
light
a book
touch.
You can, yeah, he has a light touch, and that's so important for readers to engage with that story, because it could easily, but you could easily write about that school in a very heavy way, and it takes a really good author to pull off that balance, I think, between not being superficial but also giving the reader that, you know, that relief of the humour that runs throughout it. Just some of the beauty of the writing. Mm. He says, when it opened, the school admitted children as young as 5, a fact that swept up Elwood in a lament when he tried to sleep. All those helpless kids. Mm. Just that phrase, swept up Elwood in a lament, isn't that just beautiful? Mm. So even though he's a really sort of muscular writer and it's really lean, his writing, it is also incredibly beautiful. So that's what I mean by every sentence.
Yeah,
it kind
of
makes you want to stop at almost every sentence just to appreciate that.
There's a line later on where the two boys are cleaning out a basement for one of the board members, and they used to keep indentured servants there who had been boys who'd been at the school. And he talks about the window that they looked through and saw the milky eye of the moon. And, oh, that just stopped me in my tracks. Stunning. And I think because so much of the language is quite plain, it's not embellished.
No, nothing's embellished.
Those rare sentences that do kind of, that are more poetic, really stand out.
It's just the choice of the word. Mm. So there's nothing flowery about it. Yes, and then there's a really heartbreaking passage further on in the book about what those boys could have been. Mm. And whilst he doesn't do very much of this explicitly and does leave us to read between the lines, he does occasionally, and it has more impact because it's only done very occasionally, mention something that's makes it clear the wasted potential mm-hmm. of these boys and the wasted lives mm. in effect. And he talks about the boys could have been many things had they not been ruined by that place. Doctors who cure diseases or perform brain surgery, inventing shit that saves lives, mm. run for president, all those lost geniuses. Sure, not all of them were geniuses. Chicky Pete, for example, was not solving special relativity, but they had been denied even the simple pleasure of being ordinary.
Yeah,
it's quite heartbreaking. But as you can sort of tell from that, even that passage, mm. it's so human, it's so accessible, mm. it's really cut through with humour and, a fabulous read.
Yeah.
So if you can enjoy a book with that subject matter, I just thoroughly enjoyed it, really recommend absolutely.
It. And I think it would be a great read for book clubs. I think there's so much to talk about in there, you know, and I think it's a book you probably need to talk about afterwards because it's not just the kind of book you can read and put down and forget.
You need to take it with you. Quite short.
Mm.
It's only just 200 pages. Mm. So, yes, really excellent book and a deserving winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Mm. I don't always love the Pulitzer winners.
No, me neither.
There we go. So that was The Nickel Boys. And next up we'll be reading The Paying Guests by Sarah Waters, and Amanda and I will be back with Breasts and Eggs by Mieko Kawakami, translated by Sam Bett and David Boyd. In the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go or email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. And I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A. Bailey Karras. And Annie?
I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at Mr. _Annie.
Fabulous. We will see you next week. Bye for now.
Thanks, mate.